On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
I like to do research. I mean, I don't like to just sort of make things up. I like to know where food comes from, following the trail of a recipe from one country to the other. I'm a detective.
That's Joyce Goldstein talking about writing her latest book, The New Mediterranean Jewish Table, Old World Recipes for the Modern Home. In it, she investigates the use of ingredients like preserved lemons, sumac, and za'atar. Joyce joins us to share a different perspective of the Passover Seder table. Hi, Joyce.
Hi there.
Perhaps we should start by you reminding us the difference between the Ashkenazi way of eating and those from the three Jewish communities of the Mediterranean that you're focusing on in this book.
Absolutely. The Ashkenazi Jews are Eastern European Jews, sort of cold climate, meat and potatoes diet. A lot of them came in great numbers to the United States and mostly settled on the East Coast. Then there are the Sephardic Jews, the Jews that had to leave Spain and Portugal after the Inquisition, and they sort of blundered their way up into Italy and ended up largely in Greece and Turkey. And then there are the Maghrebi Jews, the Jews that are in North Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, and Egypt. And finally, there are what are known as the Mizrahi Jews, who are the Jews that have lived in Muslim lands since biblical times, and so Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran. And I think most people in this country think there's only one Jewish food, Ashkenazi food, because those were the people that emigrated here en masse, when in fact there's this huge repertoire of recipes that people have not associated with Judaism.
Let's talk about what happens during Passover. And I would love it if we could sort of concentrate on matzah, because matzah is so the bizarre star player of, of Passover.
Yes.
And it's fascinating to see what the really wide variety of things that these communities do with it.
Well, first of all, what's really interesting to me is I was reading a book about an Algerian Jewish community, and they lived in a courtyard, and all the families made the matzah for all of the families for the season. They worked each day and made enough for each family, so it was a communal activity. And I think that there are wonderful layered matzah pies that are the Sephardic Jews have them in Greece and Turkey. They're called minas, and they're assembled like lasagna. You sort of soak the matzah in water, dip it in egg, and then fill it. It could be with cheese and vegetables. There are some meat-filled ones, too. And they're baked in the oven and cut into squares, just like a lasagna. They're also used in soups, either crumbled on top or layered, again, like a panade, like we would do a layered Italian soup where you put the vegetables and then the bread, and instead they use matzah. They use them to make fritters. They fold them into omelets. They stuff chicken with matzah. I mean, it's an all-purpose food. And, you know, meatballs, instead of using breadcrumbs, crumbled matzah meal. So it's become an all-purpose, versatile player during the Passover season.
The recipes that really fascinated me that I, stupidly enough, have never thought of doing are the ones where they're like a frittata, basically. They're like a more eggy matzah brei.
Right. They'll do it with chicken and with peas. They'll do it with spinach. And there are any number of vegetable ones. The Jews were very, very thrifty. So spinach would be extended with matzah, giving it a little bit more bulk and body. Leeks, any other vegetables that were used. And then they're scrambled in just like a frittata and can be cut into wedges. So, yes, all-purpose matzah.
In these cases, is the matzah generally soaked so it becomes this very, like, sort of soft, yielding element in the frittata?
Sometimes it's just crumbled in and it absorbs the moisture from the egg. Sometimes it's softened slightly. And I think there's a danger in over-soaking our matzahs because they're so thin and delicate, whereas the European matzahs were a little bit thicker and hardier, and so you could soak them longer. Like when I was translating a lot of the old recipes, they'd say to soak the matzah for 5 minutes. Well, ours would be pulp by then. A minute, minute and a half would do it.
One of the recipes that isn't matzah-based that you talked about is a memory that I actually have of childhood, which is the unborn chicken eggs that we used to be able to get.
Yeah. When I was a little girl, I grew up in Brooklyn in a all-Jewish neighborhood, and we had a kosher poultry market where we would go in and pick out a chicken, and they would wring its neck and pluck the feathers and open it up, and these unborn eggs would be in there. They weren't fully formed. There were little golden yolks. And when you poached them in the chicken broth, they popped in your mouth. They had the most incredible texture. And because we can't get them anymore, sometimes what you can do is just take an egg yolk and put in a little custard cup and slide it into the soup and try to cook it just right so that it doesn't get too firm. But those were one of the treats of my childhood. And just thinking about them, I can feel them in my mouth.
Given that so many of us like to start the Seder with the soup, what soups really draw your sense of full-flavored beginning that would be a little bit different from the regular matzo ball soup that many of us are used to?
Well, there is, of course, a chicken soup with a chicken dumpling that are poached in the soup. But actually, with asparagus coming full on now, there's a gorgeous asparagus soup from the Veneto that has a little bit of saffron in it, which is a little bit lighter than eating a dumpling before you start that multi-course filling meal. So I really, really like that one a lot.
And of course, artichokes are huge right now. And we think of them a lot when we think about the food of the Mediterranean, especially Italy. Is there an artichoke dish that you love using at Passover?
Well, I usually make the carciofato di Trieste, which is a medley of artichokes, peas, carrots, asparagus, little new potatoes. It's all the new spring vegetables that are coming in. But the other thing I like to do is cook the fish with a sauce of artichokes, which is also Italian. And I remember, Evan, being with you in Italy, and we were talking to some woman in the ghetto and asking her why there was so much artichokes in the Jewish diet. And they said, because it's bitter, because it's our fate. Do you remember that?
Yes.
It's our fate.
So funny. Describe that sauce.
You saute the artichokes, and then there you can put in a little bit of citrus, onion, a little tomato, and then you just smother the fish. I mean, it can be a very simple, plain fish with that sauce. There's a number of wonderful artichoke recipes cooked with citrus, either with slices of orange and then lemon, or cooked in multiple citrus juices, orange, tangerine, lemon, that is Sicilian, that I'm sure you know, the carciofi e quattro succhi. And then there's a little bit of anchovies and capers in there. And those are wonderful, served at room temperature. So if you wanted not to have only hot vegetables at the table, doing one of those artichoke dishes would be fabulous.
There is so much in this book. I can't wait to really dive in and start cooking.
Well, good. I hope you will.
Thank you so much, Joyce.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Evan. And come up for a visit and I'll cook for you.
I would love that. We've been talking with Joyce Goldstein. Her latest cookbook is The New Mediterranean Jewish Table. You can find her recipe for carciofato di Trieste on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. For many Jewish families, Passover means suitcase-sized bundles of boxes of matzah. This bread of affliction, as it's labeled in Deuteronomy, is food for the brain, not the belly, according to writer Michael Wex. Author of Born to Kvetch, he has a new book out, Rhapsody in Schmaltz, Yiddish Food and Why We Can't Stop Eating It. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Evan.
What a marvelous book this is.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
There's just so many quotes from you that it seems best to just use your own words. You say that every mouthful of every meal begins with and is packed with moral and ritual drama. How so?
You know, the whole point, I guess, of traditional, I guess what we would now call Orthodox Judaism, is to sort of sanctify every possible human activity. So it doesn't matter what you do. There's usually some ritual attached to it, even if it's only making a blessing before you do it or after you do it. I mean, this extends as far as going to the washroom, going to the toilet. You don't say a blessing beforehand, but you do say one afterwards, thanking God for having let you get through this experience in one piece and emerge alive. Food, of course, attracts a lot more of this. So before you eat anything, you're supposed to make the appropriate blessing. And there are entire manuals outlining what blessing is to be made over which food and in what order they're to be done if you're eating more than one thing. The one food that kind of, I hate to use the verb, but that trumps all the others is bread. If you're eating bread or anything that's considered bread at a meal, you only need to make a blessing over that, and that kind of includes everything else inside it. But before you can do that, you have to wash your hands in a particular ritual fashion and make a blessing over that. So just to get to a piece of bread, just to get to a sandwich, first you've got to pour water over each hand for a certain number of times. Then you hold your hands up, you make a blessing, you dry them. You're not allowed to speak then until you go to the table, make the blessing over the bread, and take a mouthful. At the end, when you're finished eating, you have to make another much, much longer blessing that goes on for probably 3 or 4 pages in the average prayer book, thanking God for having provided you with this bread. So every time you sit down to eat, even if you do this 3 times or 4 times or 5 times a day, you can never forget the whole backdrop of belief that accompanies everything that you do.
So much of what you talk about in the book is this strange dance between the necessity to eat, the poverty of the Eastern European Ashkenazi communities, which you're focusing on, and this rule book. It really reveals why there is so much bickering in our culture.
Sure. You know, there are all kinds of different ideas as to what is really kosher and what you're really allowed to eat at a given time. And no two schools of thought agree on anything other than that, you know, the ham sandwich is definitely not going to be happening. But it also, I think, goes a fair way to explaining the Jewish obsession with food, part of which, I guess, you know, you can just write off to a kind of reflex of an immigrant mentality of people who had not had enough suddenly coming to places of abundance and being able to eat as much as they wanted. But also, there's just so much ritual, so much mindfulness, and of a distinctly non-Buddhist sort, that's attached to eating anything, that basically you've got to think about it all the time. Because these rules don't just affect consumption, but also preparation. You know, how you're allowed to prepare, what you're allowed to eat, what can be combined with what, and what can't be on the same plate as something else. This stuff all becomes second nature if you grow up in it. But it's nonetheless, it's there. And as I think as people in general grew more and more removed from that kind of practice, they retained the mindfulness, the obsession about all of this stuff without actually having kept up the religious background that made it so necessary. So they've got this reflex that simply gets redirected to, you know, to the food itself rather than to some deity that is hiding behind the food.
Let's talk about matzah, this strange cracker about which some people find to be basically like eating cardboard, but I would fight with them and say it's a delicious thing. You say it's more than mere food, that it's the essence of Judaism, despite its lack of taste, texture, and aroma.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point about matzah is this is the original Jewish food. This is the one Jewish food that comes from the Bible. You know, there's no mention of chickens anywhere in the Bible. There's certainly no mention of brisket or anything like that. The Bible actually gives a sort of anti-recipe for how to prepare matzah, which is make sure that it doesn't leaven. You know, otherwise you can do whatever you want with it, but it should not be allowed to rise. God tells the Israelites when they're still in Egypt, this is what you're going to do on the 14th day of, you know, this particular month, is you're going to bake this unleavened bread and you're going to eat it with a roasted lamb and some bitter herbs, and you're then going to put some of it on your shoulder and walk out of Egypt. You know, this was the primal Jewish food. We talk about it, the Passover Seder, we say this is the bread of affliction. This is the bread that's meant to remind us of our previous sufferings. But the idea is also supposed to be that we're looking back on that, that contained in that matzah is also the idea of, you know, God having come and redeemed us from slavery and taken us across the Red Sea, which split into two halves. Really, the whole mythos of what Judaism is and who we are and where we come from is contained in this one food. It says very specifically that you're supposed to eat it in order to remember this. That is, this is a food of ideology, not of getting full on.
Let's talk about what it may have looked like then. Was it kind of like pita?
Yeah, it seems to have been. Non-Ashkenazi, non-East European or Central and East European Jewish communities, their matzah looks very different from the stuff that most of us are accustomed to. And it looks basically like an unrisen pita. You know, it's like an unleavened flatbread. And that's probably what it was originally. What we have now originated in this form around the 14th century in areas that are now Germany. People began to worry about some of the halachic, some of the Jewish legal implications about stuff that might be rising and might not be. And they got so scared that there may be just some tincture of leaven somewhere in that dough, that what they began to do was make the dough very, very thick so that there'd be no question of its rising. You know, you have this dough that's, I guess, the consistency of a Portland cement that is then put over the fire for a very brief time, you know, after it's been smashed into very thin sheets, and you get the kind of cracker-like or very crispy sort of product that we're all accustomed to. If you look at what's called shmura matzah, this is guarded matzah. This is the stuff that very Orthodox people tend to eat over the holiday of Passover. There are these big round things that are almost inevitably burned right through with lots of little spots of carbon decorating the top and bottom of it. And generally, they're very thin. Roughly five of these matzahs stacked one on top of the other will fit inside the legal restriction as to how thick you're allowed to make matzah.
Could you take us through the process of how it's supposed to be made?
Yeah, well, generally the way it's done now, there are bakeries still that make it by hand. And usually what happens is you take wheat. Sometimes the wheat has been guarded from the time that it's in the fields. Other times only since it's been harvested. So you take wheat that is in one sense or another been watched to make sure that the kernels don't begin to sprout or to leaven. You have bowls of that wheat laid out. Then somebody with water comes from a separate room. So the wheat and the water are kept in separate rooms until the actual time of baking. The person with the water comes in, and of course the amount of water has been very carefully measured relative to the amount of wheat. You mix them together. You then pound it out with with like a rolling pin into a very, very thin sheet. Then you take what's called a radler. This is something that you roll over the top of it, and it's a toothed wheel, and it makes little pricks, little holes in the dough in order to keep it from rising. Like a bubble more than the size of a hazelnut disqualifies a matzah from Passover use. So you roll that over, you pound the thing down again, and once it's been pounded down, you put it into a hot oven for anywhere between 30 and 60 seconds, depending on the taste of the head baker. Then you take it out, and it's ready.
And how long, ideally, is this whole process allowed to take?
This whole process is not allowed to take longer than 18 minutes, because that is considered the time, according to what it says in the Talmud, that's considered the time before which the fermentation process will begin. So anything after that is suspect and has to be thrown out. After each batch of matzah is baked, everything is washed down from scratch to make it as if it hadn't been used before you can start the next batch. You know, anything left over is going to exceed that 18-minute limit and would thereby, you know, not only be not kosher itself, but it would invalidate anything that it came in contact with.
Are you aware of any artisanal matzah movement?
There's a place in upstate New York called Yiddish Farm, which is devoted to two things, speaking Yiddish and organic farming. And they have actually just this year begun an artisanal matzah program. Of course, the matzah's not ready yet, so nobody has tasted it. But they're certainly trying to do something like that.
I'm curious, when it isn't Passover, mm-hmm. what's your favorite way of eating matzah?
Avoiding it completely.
Really?
Yeah, I would have to be either pretty desperate or stuck at a kiddush, at a post-service meal in a very cash-strapped synagogue before I would eat matzah voluntarily.
Even in the form of matzah brei, fried matzah?
Matzah brei, okay, I'll give you that, at least the way I know it. And there are many different kinds of matzah brei, and people will always tell you, oh, that's not matzah brei. To me, matzah brei is like an omelet with matzah mixed into it, which is the way I was used to it. Yeah, that I will have once in a while. But again, the frying and the eggs, they take a lot of the brittleness out of the matzah.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Oh, to my pleasure.
That was Michael Wex. His book, Rhapsody in Schmaltz, is hot off the presses. Up next, we hear about another food that's often eaten this time of year. Stay close.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. It's time for the Santa Monica Farmers Market Report. Let's see what Laura Avery has in store for us this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report, and I'm talking with Amelia Salzman, who is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook and the Seasonal Jewish Kitchen Cookbook. Amelia, you're here today at the market. You're shopping for Passover. Tell us what you're looking for.
Passover is really all about spring ingredients, lamb, herbs. So that's what I'm shopping for.
And we do have lamb at the farmer's market. How are you selecting the lamb and what cut do you like to get?
I'd like to do a butterflied leg of lamb.
Is the leg the traditional cut that's used at the holiday time for Passover?
No, there really isn't a traditional cut beyond including a piece of the shank bone on the Seder plate. The story of Passover and the Exodus from Egypt really begins with a recipe. The Hebrews are commanded to fire roast a lamb, eat it nose to tail with bitter herbs and matzah. So it's sort of this like sandwich on the go. So lamb is a really important symbol. It's certainly not about a cut.
Amelia, what else is going to go into this lamb dish?
So I'm basically going to make a salsa verde, which is to chop up a lot of herbs with some garlic, maybe a dash of hot pepper. I love that we have a farmer bringing dried, crushed Espelette pepper that we can use as a seasoning, and lemon juice. And I think since we're working with lamb, some lemon zest would be great. Maybe some capers if you like anchovies. That's a classic ingredient, and it gives depth to the sauce. And, of course, olive oil.
Now, what are the proportions and what are the actual herbs? Is it pretty much just mix and match?
Well, the classic herb for salsa verde is a lot of parsley, which is a key ingredient at most Seder tables. But absolutely, a mix of spring herbs would be wonderful. Anything would be great. That as long as it tastes good together, you're good to go.
Amelia, can you just briefly walk us through, once it's either butterfly, your leg of lamb is either butterflied or going to be roasted bone in or bone out, how do you actually prepare the roast to go into the oven?
Very simply, a little olive oil and salt and pepper. And I'm going to make little shallow cuts in the surface of the meat. Let the meat sit at room temperature while you make the salsa verde. And I'm going to use a third to a half of the mixture, the salsa verde, and I'm going to rub it all over the lamb. I'm going to slather it both sides of the lamb, put it in its roasting pan, and let it sit at room temperature for maybe an hour before I put it to roast. So that's going to do two things. It's going to mean that the temperature of the lamb doesn't have to climb once it gets into the oven from cold, but it also allows all the goodness from the salsa verde to flavor and infuse into the meat and into those little shallow cuts that I made.
Amelia, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. I love the way our food tells the story, and it all comes together at the table.
So true. Thank you. That was Amelia Salzman. She's very inspired about making a lamb dish this weekend for Passover. She is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook and the new Seasonal Jewish Kitchen Cookbook. We're talking with Joe Jock, who works with Jimenez Farm, who is growing the lamb that Amelia is probably going to be choosing for her Passover recipe. And Joe, you've worked with the Jimenezes for a while. The Jimenezes are bringing in not only lamb, they also have goat and rabbit. So they're kind of into the smaller footprint animals, both carbon-wise and hoof size-wise. Joe, can you tell us, first of all, what kind of breed of lambs they're raising?
Sure, Laura. The breeds of sheep are mainly Candethan and Dorpler. They produce a large amount of milk, and they're really just delicious lambs.
So they get the two kinds of lamb. Do they buy the babies and then raise them, or are they breeding their own?
We breed our own lambs, and they're raised on grass, and they're weaned and brought to market at 7 to 8 months of age normally.
And their entire life they're spent on pasture on the farm?
That's correct.
Does that affect the quality of the meat?
Well, yes, grass-fed is very popular now, and it just tastes a lot better. And you know that they're not eating any corn or soy or anything funky or unnatural at all.
Right. Joe, do you know how many sheep are in the herd?
About 40 to 50, typically.
Do you ever worry about predators?
Well, they are out in nature, and they're free range. We have a good-sized fence, and we do have a guard dog up there at the farm. They have a German Shepherd, so I think that protects the lambs as well.
When you take the lamb to the butcher, do you have chefs or customers who request special cuts?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of times chefs or customers will request cuts that we don't normally carry in the coolers, a saddle or loin, or the other day a chef ordered the riblets with the belly attached, so we were able to have the butcher cut that a specific way for him.
And do people ever order a whole lamb?
Yes, they do, and I believe we sell at $10 a pound.
Does a whole lamb consist of all the organs as well?
Yes, and actually that's something people are requesting a lot these days, liver and the offal. It's very nutritious.
Does the lamb come here frozen or fresh?
95 to 99% of the markets we have here, the lamb is fresh and hasn't been frozen.
What is the price range of your cuts from the cheapest to the most expensive?
Okay, well, the bones are on the lowest end, and they're $4 a pound, and it goes up to $30 a pound for a rib rack. And a lot in between.
Yeah. So, Joe, it seems like lamb isn't the most popular meat in America. Do you have any ideas why that might be?
I think that people have gotten so used to eating beef and kind of a mass-produced industrial form of beef the term gamey has been attached to lamb and this sort of stuff. And if you eat a grass-fed hamburger, a beef burger, it tastes that sort of what we're used to calling gamey. I feel like there's a movement now and a wave of people that are getting more interested in eating much more natural and locally raised, locally sourced meats. We do sell a lot more lamb than we do pork and other items. So over the last, you know, close to a decade that I've been working for this farm, you know, I'm seeing a growing interest in lamb.
You've really described it in a way that makes me want to run over there right now and get some lamb. So thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you, Laura.
That was Joe Jock. He works with Jimenez Family Farm, who raise lamb, pork, rabbit, and goat up in Santa Ynez. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find Amelia Saltzman's recipe for roasted leg of lamb with salsa verde on the Good Food blog. Next up, we get a matzo ball soup recipe with a Mexican twist. Stay tuned.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. In Mexico, there's a saying, la mejor comida mexicana es la que se come en la calle y en la casa. The best Mexican food is the food that we eat on the street and at home. Patty Heenich spent her youth in Mexico City and is headed back there to shoot her James Beard-nominated PBS series called Patty's Mexican Table. She joins me today to discuss her latest book, Mexican Today. Hi, Patty. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much. And as we Mexicans say, me pusiste la piel de gallina with your introduction. You just gave me beautiful chills. Thank you.
Oh, that's very sweet. One of the things that's always fascinated me about you is that you didn't feel you could plunge right into food right away when you were sort of making that move from college to, quote, adult life. You took this very interesting road to become a political analyst. What brought you back to the kitchen?
I'm a very stubborn woman, and I kept yanking myself back to the academic field because I had this very wrong idea that once you take a step or once you climb a ladder, you have to continue in that direction, and that if I had already studied political science, which was an accident to begin with, you know, Evan, I wanted to study philosophy or literature or sociology, but when I went to the UNAM to apply, they were on strike, as it many times happens at UNAM. So a friend of mine that had come with me said, Patty, there is this great college that I'm applying to, ITAM, and it's very well known for its economics and business. And he said, they have a social sciences program. I like the college, and he told me it was very difficult, and I had gone to a very bad, academically speaking, high school and middle school. So I sort of took the challenge. A year after I started, they changed the name and content of the undergraduate degree to political science. And I just stayed because I was curious because I didn't know anything about it. And then I just stuck with it.
So you graduate and you meet a man.
Yeah, I met a lovely man. I'm lucky. I met Danny, and I was working in a think tank in Mexico, but also doing my thesis on very serious topics, democratic institutions and the relationship between governors and the federal government. And we met, we fell in love, and he wanted to get married. We decided to get married. And I said, okay, I'll marry you, but let's go abroad for a few years. So we agreed that I would apply to wherever he got a job, and he got a job in Dallas, Texas. So that's where we went.
I have to tell you that thinking of Dallas as abroad to me, is hysterical.
It is. It is. I felt the same way, Evan. So I get to Dallas. And Danny tells the story of how we were driving from the airport to our duplex rental, and he could just see the tears in my eyes as I was pretending not to be crying, looking out the window. It was so odd. It felt like Mexico, but not. People were speaking Spanish, but not the Spanish I knew. I would go to the grocery store and I would see some Mexican ingredients, but not really. I'd go to restaurants that said Mexican food and eat the food, and it was like sort of, but not. And it was all just very confusing, and it made me very nostalgic for Mexico. I was very happy to be away, but it didn't feel, as you say, abroad enough. It was like I was in sort of limbo. But the funny thing was that I'm from Mexico City, and where you're from Mexico City, I guess it may be similar to people from New York, that they feel that they're, you know, in the belly button of the country. They don't need to go out to other places. And I grew up very Mexico City centric. I didn't know that many people from other regions of Mexico. And when we moved to Dallas, I started meeting Mexicans from very different regions and very different places. And I was a terrible, horrible, dreadful, awful cook. And I really wanted to learn because I was very nostalgic. Daniel was traveling all the time. And I wanted to feel nurtured with the flavors and smells that I remembered from home, which was so close yet so far away, you know, because I was getting my papers, so I couldn't leave Texas. And I would start asking anybody who spoke Spanish with any accent, I would say, you know, how do you make your arroz rojo and at the grocery store? How do you make? And I started cooking Mexican food from other regions and from other places just from trying to get that Mexican feel. But you are so very right. And then from we lived there for like 3 years, finished my thesis, and I did work for a while with the local PBS station on a cooking show. But that was also accidental.
It seems like accidents played a really serendipitous role in your life.
Very, very, yes. And I have learned, because I am a very opinionated person, and I say black or white, yes or no. And I have learned with age that nothing is definitive, that something may look white now, but tomorrow it's really gray. I'm a big fan of public radio and public TV since I moved, because that's what kept me company when I first moved abroad. And I went and knocked on the door of the local PBS station because they kept announcing and announcing that they were working on a documentary for the Mexican Revolution. And I went there and they said, whoops, we were done with that, but we have a cooking show. And it was Stephen Pyle's New Tastes from Texas. And they needed a production assistant and they had no money. And I said, pay my room and board and I'll go. And I went back to Mexico to assist them in connecting with Mexico through food. And for me, it was the most amazing experience. It was like seeing my country in a whole other light. And of course, I had an insane weight of nostalgia. So I go to the Mexican market, and I grew up going to Mexican markets. But when I went back with them, it was like, oh, Mexican market, you know, and the colors and the everything. And I came back to Texas and I was fascinated. And my husband told me, Patty, that's what you should be doing. You're like happy, you're alive. You're, and I was like, yeah, he wants me in the kitchen. That's not going to happen. So I went back, did a master's, worked at a think tank until it got to a point where I was so unhappy with what I was doing. And I'm not an unhappy person usually, so it was really dawning on me that I had been unhappy for that long, and I decided to resign and switch, and I love eating, so it's just like the perfect thing.
One of the things that fascinates me about you is you don't only have this point of view where you got to move out of your culture and then go back in and see it from a different perspective. Within Mexico, you were sort of the other in a way.
Yes.
Because your grandparents,
yes,
were Jewish immigrants from Europe.
Yes. And you touch on a very sensitive point that I've grappled with for a long time. And I think it hasn't been 2 or 3 years, really, that reason that I've come to put all of my pieces together and be comfortable with all of the different parts that I am. And I think it has to do with being in the U.S. Because, yes, Mexico is a country full of mixes, you know, and there's the Spanish and the Native Mexican and the European, and there's also the African, the Asian, the Lebanese, but it's not that well, like, known or taught. My parents are Mexican, I'm Mexican, but it was always, you know, my last name didn't sound Spanish or Mexican. And being Jewish in Mexico, it's, you are different in a way. And, you know, we didn't grow, me and my sisters, we weren't fully part of the Jewish community at all. We're not a religious family, and we didn't go to Jewish school or to any form of JCC. And I remember, like, on the first day of classes, the teachers would run the list, you know, Pepe Suarez, that, and when they got to my name, they would raise their head, you know, to see who was that different person. And it was funny because I felt like I was, you know, in between worlds in Mexico, loving being a Mexican, you know, and I had that part that I was sort of, you know, a little bit embarrassed by, because why am I different? You know, why am I different? And then when I moved to the U.S., it was like, okay, now I'm the Mexican that doesn't look like a Mexican. So now I'm like, this is what I am. This is who I am. And I have put all of my pieces together, and I see no more contradictions anymore.
I'm really curious how it played out at the table in your house. Were there any mashups of traditional dishes?
Yes, so many. My grandparents, and I had very different grandparents. On my mother's side, my grandmother was Austrian, my grandfather was Czech, and they were very sophisticated. And my grandmother's sister had the best ever Austrian bakery after she survived the Second World War. My grandmother found her in the Red Cross. She brought her to Mexico. She opened this amazing pastry shop. On my father's side, they came from peasants in Poland. They were so simple, and they cooked three things. But oh my God, the food at their house was incredible and so generous and filled with love. And so it was very different foods, but both pairs found a way, as the entire Jewish community in Mexico, to enrich Ashkenazi food. And I've seen it also in Lebanese and Turkish communities in Mexico, whether Jewish or not, you know, that's where tacos al pastor comes from. To find a way to enrich and to enhance the foods. So, for example, it's the matzo ball soup with certain kind of spices, or it's the gefilte fish a la veracruzana, or it's all these things. But it's not like it was unique to my family. Those are recipes that have now become traditional Mexican recipes for the Jewish community in Mexico. So it's very interesting.
Very interesting. I want to talk for a minute about avocado with you.
My heart is made of avocado.
So are ours in Los Angeles. You know, we used to be Mexico. We're Alta California, right?
Yes, paisana.
Was it your grandmother who would put gribanes?
Yes. And what you're talking about is so good. It's making my mouth water. Okay, so in Mexico, we have chicharrones, which is, I'm sure you have them here in California. It's the fried pork skin that has a little bit of meat as well. And it's savory, salty, crunchy. Well, the Jewish Ashkenazi version is the chicken skin. So my bobe on my father's side, who was Polish, she used to have always in her refrigerator a big jar of schmaltz. And she would cook chicken all the time, you know, for chicken broth, for knedlach or matzo ball soup or anything. And she would render the fat of the chicken skin. And that was the schmaltz, which she used to season absolutely everything. And then the gribanes, which is that fried skin, which is so tasty, is like the Jewish chicharrones. She would add on top of mashed avocado, but she would sometimes combine it with hard-boiled eggs.
To me, this is a genius egg salad idea.
It is incredible. So you chop the hard-boiled eggs with ripe avocado, a little bit of onion, a little bit of salt, nothing else. And then you tuck that into warm corn tortillas or on a top of challah bread. And then you top it with a generous amount of gribanes, and you're set.
Wow.
That's your Friday night.
And you also talk about avocado in a really moving way in the book when you describe the simplest taco you ever ate in the middle of an avocado grove.
And that was the best taco I've ever eaten. So I was in an avocado orchard, and you know, we were with the workers. They were showing us how they harvest, how they, you know, it's very interesting how the Hass avocados are grown, because they have to put two plants together for every tree. And so they were showing us how they pick the avocados and all the technique, how they pack them. And it was time for lunch, and we sat under like a very simple shade, and they had a big basket with the most perfect, gigantic, gorgeous avocados that you've ever seen. And the wife of one of the workers came like an alarm clock the moment we sat down, and she had a gigantic stack of freshly made, super pliable, soft, warm corn tortillas that she had just made. This guy, who was the husband of that woman, grabbed his machete, and he opened up a couple of those avocados, scooped them out, I don't know how or how fast. We have the slices of avocado. We tucked them into the corn tortillas, and they had very, very coarse salt. We added some of that salt. And then in the corner, they had a big bucket of these very thick syrup, and it looked very caramelly, a very deep brown. And I asked what it was, and they said, it's the honey from the avocado trees. Have you ever tried it? And I said, never. And they said, it is the most exquisite honey, but we do not sell it because we don't make enough of it. It's just a very exotic thing. So I grabbed the little spoon that was there, drizzled some of the honey, and I haven't been able to replicate those bites.
Wow. Sounds so good.
And so simple. It's like 4 ingredients, 3 minutes.
Perfect.
Perfect.
You live in Washington,
yes.
D.C. You've had the opportunity of cooking for President Obama, I understand.
Yes.
What did you make for him?
We made so many things. I had the privilege of cooking for him and his guests along the side of José Andrés, who is just such an incredible and amazing, brilliant chef. And we made just, I mean, you name it. We made all kinds of guacamoles and different kinds of tacos and cochinita and jericayas and tres leches cake.
What is jericaya?
Jericaya is a dessert from the state of Jalisco. It's a very traditional dessert that came from the Spanish, was adapted in Mexico, and it is like a cross between a flan and a creme brulee. Very simple to make. And it was a privilege, and I'll tell you, one of the best things about cooking that day was working with the White House chef. Chris Comerford is a woman. She's an immigrant. She's from the Philippines, and she's an extraordinary, hardworking, low-key, humble, incredible woman. And I really admire her. Right before the president was going to say his speech, they said, you know, all of the cooks, all of the chefs, please come into this room. We went into this room. We don't know what's going on. And then they say, okay, in exactly 7 seconds, the president is going to come in, and he's going to go right here. And they made a space right in between me and José Andrés, and I was like. So the president comes in, so charming. I mean, so energetic, so charismatic, and he's cracking a joke with absolutely every person he's saying hi to. It was a great experience.
You are always such a delight. Thank you so much, Patty.
Thank you, Evan. Anytime, it's my treat.
We've been talking with Patty Heenich. Her new cookbook is Mexican Today. The 5th season of her show, Patty's Mexican Table, will air on PBS in September. You can find her riff on matzo ball soup with mushrooms and jalapenos on the Good Food blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, we find out where Jonathan Gold is eating this week. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program Morning Becomes Eclectic can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app and get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. As he does every week, Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is in the studio with me. Where are you taking us?
Well, there's a place called Maruno that a lot of people are excited about and specializes in pinchos Maruno, which are skewers with chicken or with lamb that are marinated with olive oil, lemon juice, and like a cumin-heavy spice mixture that's really close to a Tunisian or Moroccan ras el hanout before they're grilled.
Spanish shish kebabs, that seems very niche.
It is. One of the guys involved is David Rossoff, who was the wine guy at Moza forever and at Campanile before that. And he obviously has an interest in having a great place to drink wine, especially wines from Spain and the southern part of France that border Spain.
And who is the chef partner in this?
Chris Feldmeier, who was also at Moza for a really long time. The wine that the restaurant is devoted to is the vermouth that David Rossoff makes.
He's having a vermouth made especially for this project?
Right. There's a white one, which is aromatic, and there's a red one, which is a little bit sweeter, more concentrated. And the way it's served is almost like a meal. And you get not one, but three olives neatly skewered on a toothpick. You get a big thing of orange stuck to the outside of the glass. So you have a little snack, then you have a drink, then you have a snack, and you have a drink, and you're still on your drink. Although you're probably going to want to get something called Gildas.
Now, what is a Gilda?
Gilda is a favorite tapa or pincho of the Basque country with one olive, one anchovy, one pepper.
And it's kind of a genius little bite because it just makes you drink more.
It's salty and it's pungent and it's juicy. And yeah, you definitely want to drink with it.
Is it related to Rita Hayworth in any way?
It is. It apparently became a fad in the Basque country and then all over Spain after the movie Gilda starring Rita Hayworth was released. And I think it has a nice resonance. A, it takes you back to Spain. B, Rita Hayworth's family was from Sevilla, where a lot of the food and the influences of Chris Feldmeier are from. And C, obviously, Rita Hayworth grew up around there. She went to Hamilton High.
God, I love that.
So it becomes completely appropriate on a Spanish context and completely appropriate on a local one.
A lot of people would probably find it interesting or maybe even odd that vermouth would be an aperitif or a cocktail of choice.
It actually goes really well with food, and you can sip it by itself, obviously. There's definitely a thing in northern Spain for vermouth bars at the moment. There's a couple of really good ones in Barcelona.
But I would imagine that David goes beyond vermouth in the list.
Oh, yeah, it's a great list. It's largely natural wines. There's a lot of stuff you haven't heard of.
What are we eating besides these little gildas?
There's a lot of stuff. All of it pretty savory and all of it goes really nicely with wine. There's salt cod salad. There's a really nice sort of flat tortilla española flavored with herbs. There's a really good artichoke dish. It's like the leaves that are crisped on a flat top, a plancha, and tossed with a little olive oil, a lot of salt. Something that I really love that I've managed to get every time I've been there, which is a half cabbage blistered and blackened on a rotisserie that's cut in half and smothered with yogurt and pickled mushrooms. One of the interesting things about the menu here is that it seems to center on the intersection of North African flavors and Spanish flavors, which makes sense because, you know, Moruno refers to Moors. Southern Spain and a lot of Spain was under Islamic control until the 15th century. And the flavors are still there everywhere you look.
So there's going to be like cumin and coriander and Ras al Hanout. And we should say that Ras al Hanout is considered to be the king or the queen of spice blends of North Africa.
There's Ras al Hanout places you would never expect Ras al Hanout to be.
What else is good there?
There's Mejadra, which is a dish of rice and lentils with onions on top. Very close to dishes you'd find in Egypt or in Lebanon. It's particularly delicious there. There's a dish of butternut squash that's cut in half and grilled until, again, it's black and the skin becomes crisp. And it's sprinkled with dukka, which is that mixture of spices and nuts that's so delicious.
Wow.
It's funny how you go to a restaurant that's named after meat, and yet so many of the interesting things are vegetables.
Now, what about the French fries?
The French fries are dusted with a powder that's made apparently by cooking lentils and beans with spices until they're very dry and then grinding them into a powder and dusting them with it.
Which is kind of like an Indian gunpowder.
They actually call them gunpowder fries, so you win the prize.
There you go.
They're really good fries. Another thing they do that you would absolutely not expect in a Spanish restaurant is, I guess, a dish of spinach with chickpeas that tastes very much like something Punjabi. And you can get it with batura, which is this puffy fry bread.
Which is definitely from India.
So from India.
I love this.
By the time you get to the sort of larger dishes, you're probably already full, but some of them are great. They do they call them pork belly chicharrones, but it's a slab of pork belly that's about the size of a Smith & Wesson.
Wow.
You know, very, very crisp, hard, so rich, you won't be able to eat more than a bite or two. There's rotisserie chicken, which is heavily spiced on the outside, probably more Ras al Hanout there. And it's sort of sticky and lovely in that way that rotisserie chicken gets sometimes. And something that I wasn't expecting at all, but one of the great tripe dishes in Los Angeles.
Really?
From what I gather, they simmer it for a really, really long time until it gets to that sort of melting phase. I mean, like tripe alla romana. And then they dust it with spices and they slap it on the grill. And it gets super crunchy and, you know, almost sizzling and bubbly, and it's these flat black things. And it's served with beans, these giant white beans that have been cooked with a little vinegar and a lot of garlic. And it's just a magnificent dish.
Well, that sounds really unusual and wonderful, very textural.
The other thing that you should probably know about the restaurant is that the desserts are, I think, secretly overseen by Chris Feldmeier's wife, Dalia Narvez, who, of course, is the wonderful pastry chef at Moza. There's the chocolate sesame tart with curls of halva or the saffron-scented rice pudding lightened with whipped cream, and most especially the dessert of biscuits that have been deep fried until they're super light and crunchy, served with vanilla ice cream and a little bit of tangerine marmalade.
Now, when you say biscuits, do you mean a cookie or do you mean a biscuit?
I mean like a southern biscuit. It sounds like a
fair food.
Yes. We're essentially talking about deep fried butter, ice cream, and jam, but it's so good.
Yum. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Moruno, which is located in the original Farmers Market at 3rd and Fairfax. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. If you missed any part of today's show, don't worry. You can listen whenever you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. And of course, as always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Say, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.